science enthusiasts. I'm your host, Jason Zukowski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dogs, Bunsen and Beaker. They're the science dogs on social media. This show takes what's best from their account, the curiosity and fun found there, and swirls it into podcast form. Every week, we're going to take some deep dive into an area of science and look at the research that's going on with our pets. We'll also have an expert guest who will enthrall you with their area of knowledge. This is the Science Podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Science Podcast. Thanks for tuning in week after week to listen to this goofy show. We're back from holidays. It's great to be home in our own beds, and the dogs are pretty happy to be home too. But having some time away in a different part of the world where we can bring the dogs is just magical. The west coast of Canada is gorgeous, and I'm sure we'll talk about that more in the family section. This week in the podcast, in Science News, we're going to talk about some lasers that are trying to make fusion happen. What? In pet science, we're going to talk about that contentious Twitter post about cats be murdering. Our guest and Ask the Expert is Beth Fitzpatrick, who's a senior environmental consultant. And her chat about things that she's had to work with in the environment is really interesting. So I can't wait to share that interview with you. Okay, dogs, this joke is a little bit specific. Every time I see it, it makes me laugh. Which is more environmentally friendly, Facebook or our jokes on Reddit? Well, Facebook produces too much plastics, while r/jokes has a 100% recycling rate. Okay, on with the show, because there's no time like science time. This week in science news, we're going to talk about some lasers that are trying to make a milestone for nuclear fusion. In the last couple months, we've talked to actually a couple nuclear engineers, and I love talking to somebody who knows science about nuclear things, because aside from like a really broad brush, I'm not that confident in what I know about nuclear systems. Alberta's energy runs off of coal and natural gas, so we don't even have to wrap our heads around that. Only really Eastern Canada have nuclear reactors, so it's something that's really alien to most Canadians is nuclear power. And fusion is like the holy grail, right? Because we have fission where atoms are split apart, but fusion is like what happens in the sun. So this fusion story has to do with a milestone that was reached. This experiment was at one of the biggest laser facilities in the world and released 1.3 million joules of energy. Now, a joule isn't a lot of energy. If you want to talk about lots of energy, of course, there's the sun. You scale that down to something else that releases a lot of energy, like a nuclear weapon. You're talking about, you know, trillions or billions of joules, most likely trillions. So a million is, you know, a lot less than that. But compared to something that would kind of make sense to our world is a calorie. A kilocalorie has 4,184 joules. So a million's pretty good. Now, why is this important for fusion? This laser energy came close to something that's known as the break-even point of ignition. And that's where fusion starts to produce more energy than it takes to cause it to occur. This is a big deal because we haven't really reached this point ever. Fusion sort of works. We've had the nuclear engineers discuss that before, but we've always had to put way more energy in than we've gotten out, which isn't great as an energy source. But this milestone is a big deal. Now, how did they get there? Well, it's pretty technical. The National Ignition Facility, or NIF, N-I-F, at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, pummeled this little tiny capsule with lasers. And all of this was performed on August 8th, so relatively recent. From bombarding this little capsule with all of this laser energy, it actually produced 10 quadrillion watts of power over 100 trillionths of a second. So a little blip of energy. What was really interesting about, like, I don't even know how to make that energy make sense. That's a crazy amount of energy, but it happened really, really, really quickly. So it was over in the blink of an eye. But what was really interesting also that went with this story is the little capsule didn't absorb all the energy. It really didn't. It could only absorb a little bit. So there's a lot of excess energy. So the team was pretty happy with that. The Carolyn Curzan, who's a plasma physicist from the University of Michigan, said that that's amazing because that means that they produced five times as much energy that was absorbed. So as long as they can just keep working on absorbing more of that energy, they have the energy there. It just isn't being absorbed by the reaction capsule. Now, this hasn't been published in a scientific journal yet. It's just, you know, from the team very excitingly talking about it. So I'm sure it's going to be peer reviewed in the future. And that's something like when I was a kid, fusion was like 20 years away. Well, 20 years have come and gone and fusion is still, you know, 20 years away. This is getting us closer. Maybe we'll never reach it. When you think about the fusion that's happening in the sun, like there's some crazy gravity and crazy temperatures going on there. For us to mimic that on Earth is very difficult. Besides NIF or NIF, there's a ton of other projects around the world working on fusion. I mean, if they could figure this out, you're talking about readily available stuff on Earth with the energy that it would give off would be way more than nuclear fission, way more than a carbon hydrogen bond in natural gas or you know, coal, and like magnitudes more than the intermittent power of solar energy and wind power. Just a little bit, if you're wondering kind of the setup of that, they had some pictures of this that would be happening at the microscopic level. And it's basically a whole bunch of lasers. 172 laser beams are converged on this little tiny cylinder containing the fuel. And when that laser hits the cylinder, X-rays kind of like bomb blast out and it vaporizes the exterior, which causes the fuel to implode within. And that's the whole idea, right? Fusion is putting things together. So the fuel is a mix of deuterium and tritium, these types of hydrogen. And as that fuel kind of implodes, it reaches the proper density, pressure, and temperature to fuse that special hydrogen into helium. And that's what happens in the sun. Once you get that going, it causes a huge temperature rise, and that makes it easier to heat the rest of the fuel. And that's a fusion chain reaction. It's a milestone. Should we be too excited about this? I mean, it happened for a trillion, what was it, 100 trillionths of a second. It is cool. They got to a temperature, they got to a amount of energy that basically is kind of the cusp of break even, where fusion begins to release more energy than it absorbs. I don't know what that means for the future. I'm not going to hold my breath because I was pretty sure by the time I was the age I am now, we would have fusion, and we don't. But you know what? Those fusion scientists out there, don't give up. It'd be an amazing breakthrough. If it doesn't happen for 100 years and, you know, my kids' kids benefit from it, that's amazing. That's science news for this week. This week in pet science, let's talk about cats and they be murdering. So nothing is more contentious on Twitter than when people get their hackles up about their pets, politics, and religion. Now, this story has nothing to do with religion or politics, but it does have to do with cats. And I shared a Twitter article, and luckily there's only a couple grumpy people in the thread, and I went into the study. It's a really good study. But the original poster, boy, there was like a massive fight, and it has to do with cats being left outside to their own devices and what happens. Now, we've spoken before that outside cats are an ecological disaster. The big study that is always quoted is back from 2013 in Nature. It estimates that they kill between 1 in 4 billion birds every year. So yes, cats that are outside can be used to clean up vermin. That is true. That is absolutely true. They kill a whole bunch of other little critters. They're great at it. But they also decimate birds. And what the study was groundbreaking, this one from 2013 was talking about, is that we don't really see them kill the birds. They're kind of sneaky about it. You don't see your outside cat murder a whole bunch of birds, but they do. Figured it out. Now, this study's along the same idea, but they added an extra thing where, just to make it a little bit more specific, they gave these cats GPS backpacks. And they were in 6 different countries. So it's not just one area. So some of the countries were the United States, United Kingdom, Australia, and New Zealand. Maybe Canada. I don't know. I'd have to go into the... And they took a look at 925 pet cats that were free roaming. They were allowed to go outside. And they took a look at how much animals they hunted down, because they could take a look at the GPS movements and track them Also, how fast they were moving, did they move, catch something, so on and so forth. They could also find out where they were and watch the cats with the GPS location. Now, the conclusion of the study in animal conservation is that cats kill between 2 and 10 times more wildlife than native predators. What's a native predator? Well, let's say where we live, like a coyote or a fox or one of the sketchy weasels or the badgers that live up in the hill. An outside cat will do better 2 to 10 times as much. A couple other interesting things they found in this study is that cats that got most of their meals in their house, when they were let outside, they stayed pretty close to the house. So anything they killed was really concentrated around their home. There were a couple super predators that roamed further and had a much larger impact on the prey population further out from the house. So that doesn't mean they're killing less. It just means they're killing more around their localized around their house. Now, if you want to compare a house cat to a jungle cat will kill around 400 mice in a month, whereas the super predator cats might kill 11 in a month. So compared to a jungle cat, you might say, well, okay, you know, the jungle cat's killing way more. But remember, there's a couple different issues here. Jungle cats hunt for prey across a massive range of 605 hectares, whereas the pet cats in the study stayed within a 3.6 hectare range of their home. That's about 100 meters. One of the things the study found is that pet cats left to roam do crazy damage to anything that's living around the house. So yeah, they might get rid of all the mice that live around your house, but they're probably going to get rid of most of the birds too. The conclusion of the study, just like the one from 2013, is cats are too dangerous to be left outside. Even cats that you have for mousing. And that was what the tough sell on Twitter. People were very upset about that. They're like, my farm cat kills all the mice. My farm cat kills all the mice. It's great at killing vermin. True. However, it's killing a lot of other bird life too, which is required and necessary for the ecosystem. Like animals that should be in the ecosystem, and cats are not. Cats are an artificially introduced organism in just about every place in the world. Don't get me wrong, cats are cute and cuddly, and my family loves them. But all of the cats that my family has stays inside. That's Pet Science for this week. Hey everybody, thanks for listening to the Science Podcast this week. The Science Podcast is always going to be free to download, but if you want to support the show, there's a couple things you can do. The first one is sign up on our Patreon page, patreon.com/BunsenBurner. There's multiple tiers of support. We have a ton of fun with the patron group. You get to be on the podcast. You get postcards from Bunsen and Beaker. You get swag. You get early pictures. You get a whole bunch of awesome stuff. So check it out. The lowest tier is only $5 a month. The other way you could support the show is checking out our merch shop. Our merch shop is hilarious. It's got all of these adorable cartoons of Bunsen and Beaker. We keep producing more. I just want to thank the people that have supported the show that way. We're really, really proud of our merch shop because the merch, the clothes, is really high quality. The colors are vibrant, and we come up with some really fun designs all the time. So check it out. That's at BunsenBurnerBMD.com. Thanks, everybody. On to the interview. It's time for Ask an Expert on the Science Podcast, and I am excited to talk to Beth Fitzpatrick, who is an environmental consultant, toxics use reduction planner. There we go. I got it. I'll be able to edit it together. how are you doing today, Beth?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thank you.
Where are you calling into the podcast from?
I'm calling in from Rhode Island, which is the smallest state in the United States.
It's like our Prince Edward Island in Canada. It's like the little teeny tiny province that Canada has.
So we're about 48 miles north to south and 37 miles east to west. So I believe that's about 77 kilometers by about 60 kilometers.
Oh, I'd have to check for Prince Edward Island. It is tiny too. I know it's very, very, very small. So you could easily say you drove across your state in like a couple hours.
Oh, way less than a couple hours. But it's kind of funny because people who live in Rhode Island don't really like to drive more than 10 or 15 minutes.
And oh,
the big joke is if it's more than 15 minutes, you need to pack a lunch.
That's hilarious. we've had people visiting from Europe, right? And in Europe, driving long distances is crazy. So Alberta is like Texas. It's huge. Anywhere we got to go, you got to drive for hours and hours and hours. And that's one of the things that folks who have been visiting from Europe is like, boy, there's so much driving. So in Rhode Island, it's similar to that. Hey, it's just ridiculous to have to drive for a very long time.
Yes, it is.
Correct. and Beth, the other question we've been asking our guests, and I don't know how much longer I need to ask this for. I hope I don't have to ask it for much longer, but are you and your family doing okay with coronavirus?
Yes, we are. So my husband and I were fully vaccinated in May, and our parents, that was very exciting. And our parents were fully vaccinated in April. And so we haven't quite dove into the deep end of the pool, so to speak, but there are activities that we're doing this year that we weren't doing for the last 15 months. Mm-hmm. So for example, I usually, you know, in the past I raced sailboats on Tuesday nights, and I'm back to doing that this season. We have plans to go camping this summer, which previously, you know, didn't happen for 15 months. And we've been able to see our family as well, which again, we didn't do that for a solid 15 months as well.
Yeah, exactly. But if you're fully vaccinated and you're visiting with people who are fully vaccinated, our health body in Canada is like, it's probably pretty safe. You're probably okay.
We feel the same way, but to be honest, we're probably not big crowd people to start with anyway. Mm. So that's probably part of the reason why we haven't jumped in, you know, full into the deep end of the pool.
Yeah, it's going to be weird in like a year or two to I don't know. I have an event in September that's going to have crowds, and I'm just having a little bit of anxiety about it. So it's going to be definitely weird to try to get back into that mindset.
And it's been interesting just, you know, because I do visit a lot of client sites. It's been interesting to try to figure out how you're going to do, you know, greetings, because handshakes, some people aren't on board with that anymore. And mm-hmm. some people want to do fist bumps, and some people just kind of wave. And it's interesting territory to navigate right now, for sure.
Yeah, I believe I'm not sure what Dr. Fauci's title is in the United States, but he's like your big coronavirus guy. I apologize. I don't know what his title is. But he mentioned like handshakes might be something that we just say goodbye to. Because they're so good at spreading diseases. And our medical officer in Canada, Dr. Teresa Tam, she kind of said the same thing. So yeah, it's going to be, greetings are going to be weird again, hey?
It definitely is.
Okay. Well, let's talk about you. You are an environmental consultant, and you have like a really cool career, and you do some amazing work. Could you talk a little bit about what your training in science is?
Sure. So my background is chemical engineering. And when I was going to college, environmental engineering and environmental science wasn't really a well-developed major yet. And I knew that I wanted to head that direction, but I wasn't entirely sure what I should do. Because as I mentioned, the major wasn't fully developed yet. And so I really liked chemistry, and I really liked problem solving. And I've thought that chemical engineering would be a good way to get me to ultimately what has become environmental engineering and environmental science. And so that was the route I went. And
from your early age, were you interested in science? Like you said, you were always interested. Was there one event that precipitated it? Was there an aha moment, or was it like a slow burn?
So I do not remember a time where I didn't love science and wasn't very curious about science, and it was all science. I, you know, enjoyed catching lightning bugs and trying to figure out how they worked. I watched every single solitary Jock Who's So Special that was on TV. Yeah. And but chemistry really caught my eye from an early age as well. And I think the two things that really did it for me was baked goods and the classic baking soda and vinegar experiment.
Well, so, both of those are used in baking. So there you go.
So with baked goods, you know, you think about it, you have things like butter, sugar, flour that you might not necessarily want to eat a bunch of on its own, but you might mix it in very specific ratios and apply heat, and you get wonderful things like cookies that you want to eat a lot of. And to me, that was
tell me about it.
It was so interesting that you could take these things and transform it into something wonderful. And then with baking soda and vinegar, I was probably, oh, I want to say maybe six when I discovered baking soda and vinegar. And I tried to optimize that reaction. Oh. And I went through so much baking soda and vinegar trying to figure out like what was the best proportion to get the biggest reaction, but not using too much, because if you use too much, then you wouldn't be able to have as much supplies to make it happen over and over again. And it got to the point where my mom actually started hiding the baking soda in the house because I was just going through so much of it. And so that was the spark for me being interested in chemistry. And then when I was about 13, the Bhopal gas disaster happened in India.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Right. And so that was, I believe it was a water reactive chemical that had water introduced into a tank, and then methyl isocyanate got released as an event, and thousands of people died from that. And
yeah, it was tragic.
It was one of the biggest industrial disasters at the time. And I remember being very blown away by that incident, and that really sparked my interest in making sure that surrounding communities stay safe when you have a facility that's handling and processing chemicals.
Yeah, baking soda and vinegar is like such a innocent reaction. You get some of it in your eyes, it stings. But it was that other event maybe that made some of the chemistry more sinister, but also I guess as you're saying it, it gave you the spark to pursue a career to protect people from chemical reactions that maybe go south.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh. And to this day, that's still a big component of some of the work I do.
Wow. That's cool. Thanks for sharing that. It was a disaster, but it precipitated your journey into chemistry. Precipitated. So now you're an environmental consultant, and you sent me a little like a resume or I forget what that's called, the CV file, a LinkedIn thing. And man, I was just blown away by some of the stuff that you've been doing in your career. You've done in your career. You had so many different clients and tasks and jobs. Could you talk about some of the things you've done as an environmental consultant? I'm sure our audience would love to hear some of your stories.
Sure. So I'm going to give you three examples of very different projects that I've done, but all were very interesting and very rewarding to me.
Yay.
So early on in my career, I worked for a company that was focused a lot on lead and asbestos. And I would help at construction sites where particularly they were overpasses for bridges on highways, where bridge workers were blasting off lead-based paint. And part of my job was to ensure that when they did this removal of lead-based paint, that it stayed contained and it didn't enter the environment. But a more interesting part of the job, I thought, was that I was trying to assist those bridge workers in not bringing lead contaminant home. Because at the time, it was about five times more likely for their children to have lead poisoning than the average child in the state of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And so I was working with them, trying to ensure that they understood that their actions or inaction could get their child very, very sick. And children under six are very, very susceptible to lead poisoning. And they could have brain development issues. They could have central nervous system issues. And it impacts bone development as well.
Doesn't the lead block, like, isn't it, it blocks a neurotransmitter or something like that? I remember reading that. Or
it does that. It does that. And then in the bones, your bones confuse lead for calcium.
Oh man, that's rough.
Bone development. Yes. Yes. So that was kind of interesting to take these bridge workers and try to help them make sure that their family stayed healthy. And so that was very rewarding.
I have a couple follow-up questions. Like, what were some of the things they were doing that were tracking lead back to their household?
So I would say probably one of the biggest things were they weren't washing up before they left the site. And then one of the things that happens a lot is, you know, they wear steel toe boots to work and, you know, they're traipsing around through the containment area where there's all kinds of lead chips on it. And then they get in their car with their boots on and they drive home with their boots on, and they walk through the front door with their boots on, and everywhere they're going, they're tracking lead with them. And so the kids are getting exposed to the lead inside the house, the lead in the car. And particularly with kids that are younger, there's a lot of hand-to-mouth activity that occurs.
Yeah.
And so if they pick up lead dust, you know, on the floor and then they suck their thumb or whatnot, then they're ingesting lead.
Right. Because it particulates in the air, like it kind of floats there as like if it's disturbed. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes.
Yeah. Or it falls, it can fall to the ground, but it can also kind of like hang there to be breathed in.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Were they receptive to what you were talking about? It would seem like it would be a tough sell to tell them this invisible thing could make their kids sick.
Well, it was a tough sell. And particularly at the time, you know, I was right out of college and I looked fairly young for my age. So, you know, I looked like some 16-year-old kid trying to tell a grizzled bridge worker what he needs to do.
Oh, man.
And so that was a little bit of an uphill battle. But, you know, but thankfully, you know, ultimately some of them started listening to me and the bridge workers had to have their blood lead level tested monthly. And, you know, they could see their blood lead level decreasing if they listened to me. And then it sort of caught on where like, hey, maybe this person knows what she's talking about.
Oh, man. Were you intimidated at all? I would be intimidated talking to a grizzled bridge worker.
Well, I'm
a big guy. I'm 6'3".
Yeah, I'm only like 5'4". And then to add another layer to it, because a lot of the work was highway overpass, you know, work, typically we weren't allowed to work until the evening. So my shift would be like 6 p.m. to 6 a.m.
Oh, in the dark, too.
In the dark. Yeah. You know, so on the side of the highway.
Oh, man. Well,
so that was one of my first projects out of college.
There you go. You got some street cred with me now. as the kids say.
Yes, exactly. So that was kind of one of the interesting first projects I worked on. And then one of my favorite projects is with an island that's 13 miles out to sea. That's part of Rhode Island. And it's a very, very special place. It's one of the 12 last great places, according to the Nature Conservancy. And there's about 900 year-round residents, but they can get up to 25,000 people doing day trips, you know, during the summer or beach season.
Do you have to take a boat out there, hey? Like, do they bomb? They bomb out on a boat. Okay.
Boat or a plane. So
really?
It's about an hour ferry ride or a 10-minute plane ride.
Oh, I'd imagine some fairly wealthy folks have like cabins and houses on this island, or is it, or no?
It's an interesting mix where it's some celebrities where if I said their name, you would definitely recognize them. And then it's some people where, you know, their family was one of the original families that founded the island in 1660. And they're still there several generations later.
Right. Having a house on the island in the 1700s is a little bit different than building one in like the 2000s. So.
Exactly.
Sorry, I didn't mean to derail your conversation.
No, it's fine.
Go ahead.
So I did a lot of work with the power plant that's out there. And so when I first started working with them, they had 5 diesel generators that supplied all the power for the island. And they didn't have a cable to the mainland and they did not have any backup system. And we ended up assisting them with putting some air control devices on their diesel generators that reduced the amount of NOx that is emitted when it combusted the diesel fuel. And so NOx, nitrogen oxides, is an air pollutant to start with on its own, but it's also very reactive. And when it reacts with the atmosphere, it creates ozone, which increases smog levels, and it also creates acid rain.
Mm-hmm.
So we helped them put on this air pollution control device on their generators, and it reduced the NOxes that were emitted by 90%.
Wow, that's a big deal.
Which is a big deal. But subsequent to that project, there was the first offshore wind farm installed near the southeast corner of the island. And they put a cable from the wind farm to the island, and then they put a cable from the island to the mainland, because the wind farm is rated at 30 megawatts capacity, and the island, even on a busy summer day, only needs about 4 megawatts.
Oh.
And so the rest of the power goes to the mainland, you know, if they're generating at full capacity. And because there's a cable to mainland, the power can flow both directions, And so if there's a day where it's not very windy for some reason, the power can flow from the mainland out to Block Island. And so subsequently, they don't have to operate those generators very often anymore.
Right. There is a backup for intermittent power.
Yes. So if they have to do any work on the cable, you know, they'll run the generators to address the power demand on the island.
Cool. Who, I don't know if you can answer this. Who owns the wind farm? Like, is that a state thing? Rhode Island owns it, like the state of Rhode Island?
So there was a company called, I want to say it's Vineyard Wind, maybe. If you give me a second, I can look it up. But there is a company that was sort of the developer for it. But it was really interesting where Rhode Island really wanted to be the case study. And so they really tried to streamline things as much as possible and sort of make it an easy process. And it's considered sort of a beta tester because it's only 30 megawatts. But right now there's another wind farm that just got approval that will occur off of Martha's Vineyard, which is an island in Massachusetts.
I've heard of Martha's Vineyard.
So if you're a Jaws fan, you definitely have heard of Martha's Vineyard.
There you go. That's where it has some other significance in American history, doesn't it? I swear.
Sorry.
I don't know. We didn't learn American history in my school. So
yeah. Chappaquiddick was the other one.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah. I didn't mean, sorry, American viewers, listeners, some Canadians like me are pretty ignorant about American history. So
that's all right. It definitely probably goes both ways.
Okay. So that you had the bridge project and you had the island project. What was the third project you were involved with?
So the third project is my toxics use reduction planner projects. And so Massachusetts and a few other states have a regulation where if you use certain chemicals over certain quantities, you have to try to reduce the amount of chemical that you use per unit of product. So one of the companies I work with makes the chemiluminescent glow sticks where you snap them and you shake them and they glow in the dark.
I love those.
Yeah. So those are pretty awesome. And we were able to reformulate the chemicals that are contained in the glow sticks. And we now have those glow sticks manufactured without using any of the chemicals that are on the toxics use reduction chemical list.
Mm.
So it's good for the workers, you know, because they're using less toxic chemicals during the manufacturing process. It's good for the end user, you know, because if you accidentally have a glow stick leak before it's reactive, you know, you have those chemicals that are potentially getting on, you know, your clothes or wherever your glow stick happens to be. And then, you know, so it's a win-win where it's less toxic chemicals in the environment.
Yeah, I you probably have seen this before, like kids will smash those open, then smear themselves with the inside. So they've got glowy skin. And I'm like, don't do that. They're in that tube for a reason, guys. But at least with you on the case, it's not as bad as it was.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Is this chemical luminescence company the only thing that you're working with right now with that, with your position there?
No, there's usually, I have several different projects that involve toxics use reduction. So I've worked with a beverage manufacturer that makes a dark brown bubbly cola. I've worked with a company that's a concrete manufacturing plant.
Oh yeah.
I've worked with a company that manufactures transducers for sonar. I've worked with a manufacturer who makes large steel beams for infrastructure. So at any given time, I have multiple toxics use reduction planner projects going on.
And all of this stuff that we use in our daily life, from the the non-named bubbly cola to the steel girders, like it has to be created. Because you don't just like go to the bubbly cola mine and get some bubbly cola. It's created. And
correct.
And one of the things we never think about is like, how is that all made? And is there a bad, I guess, byproduct from it? So it's good to see that there's organizations like that out there that are just keeping an eye on that.
And it's really interesting to see the manufacturing process for a lot of things that you totally take for granted. You know, and I know, like glow sticks, I thought that was the coolest thing ever when I got to see how a glow stick was manufactured.
Because they'd need the shell and then they'd need the, oh, wow, that's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people sort of tend not to think about what goes into the product that gets manufactured.
No, you just have fun. It glows for a bit and then you chuck it. So
exactly.
Well, my mind is just spinning now. I would like to know more about some of the 3D plastic stuff that I use, because I know it's, some of it is not the greatest, but I know some of the companies, they say that it goes through different processes like what you're talking about to decrease the toxins in them.
So any product should have a safety data sheet. And, you know, and if you request the safety data sheet, the manufacturer has to provide it to you. Mm-hmm. And the safety data sheet will provide information such as, you know, the ingredients or the components of that product. It'll also tell you, you know, safe storage and handling. It'll tell you what's incompatible, you know, what you want to make sure you don't store near that material. It will tell you what you should do in the event of, you know, somebody needing first aid because of exposure to that material, what you do if you spill it, and what should happen if the material catches on fire. And other safety considerations, such as personal protective equipment that you should wear when you're handling the material. And that goes for anything that gets manufactured that potentially has a hazardous ingredient or a physical hazard or a health hazard. So, you know, things that you use in your house, such as cleaning supplies, those all have safety data sheets. You know, anything that you can buy at a box store probably has a safety data sheet.
Well, that's good. That's, if people are curious, then they know how to, they know they have a tool in their toolbox now.
Absolutely. And a lot of them are actually available online. So if you, you know, enter the name of your product and then you type in SDS or safety data sheet, a lot of companies make them available online and you don't even really have to do a request.
Just less work for them, hey?
Absolutely.
One question I have for you with the future of environmental consulting, you had mentioned something about PFAS.
Yes.
Could you talk to us a little bit about that? That's something I'm not super familiar with.
Sure. So it's per- and polyalkyl fluoral substances. And so it's a whole family of compounds that are man-made and, you know, and they have a fluorine element to it. And they're called forever chemicals because they don't easily break down. And in environmental consulting, PFAS compounds are considered an emerging contaminant. So there has been some toxicology data to show that there are health concerns associated with PFAS. Cancer is one of them for a few of the PFAS compounds. Also, high cholesterol. There's some also issues with reproductive, you know, reproduction issues related to fertility and whatnot. And so we're just starting to look at regulating those in the United States. So, for example, EPA just has a guideline for PFAS concentrations in drinking water, and it's not an enforceable limit. It's just a guideline.
Oh.
And a lot of And so a lot of the states, so Vermont, Massachusetts, I believe New Jersey is one of them. A lot of the states have implemented, they're starting to implement drinking water limits, and other states are looking at what to do as well. There's also states that are looking at eliminating PFAS in AFFF, which is a firefighting foam. And there's also some states that are looking at eliminating PFAS from food packaging. So things like the wrapper that your fast food comes in or the pizza box. They're looking at eliminating PFAS for that. And they're also looking at some consumer products. So for example, there was a study recently where approximately 50% of cosmetics contain PFAS.
I saw that. I was going to talk about that on the podcast, actually.
Yes.
Yeah, I saw that. That's shocking. So,
it is shocking. You know, and the PFAS is used a lot of times if you want something to be water resistant or stain resistant. And so I think people are starting to weigh, you know, risk versus reward, where, you know, in a pizza box, Do you really care if your pizza box has a little bit of staining in it? You know, I mean, is it worth risking, you know, not being able to have children and, you know, and high cholesterol and whatnot, just so your pizza box looks cleaner after you're done eating your pizza?
Well, I think if you have pizza too much, you might have high cholesterol anyways.
That's true. That's true. But particularly with the cosmetics, you know, since a lot of it is you know, water resistant. So things like mascara, where, you know, you don't want your mascara to run if you cry or if it rains or whatnot. That's why they use the PFAS. But again, you know, people are starting to weigh risk versus reward for those compounds.
Yeah. Maybe we should get to a point in society where women or whoever chooses it doesn't need to wear mascara.
Well, let me tell you, I've been on board with that idea for a long time.
That's just my opinion. Okay. Please don't send hate mail to the podcast listeners. Okay. Okay. Well, thanks for talking a little bit about PFAS. I'm going to do my own digging into Canada, right? Because we're obviously different countries. And I know the States is very, like, the government might say something, but they always leave things up to the individual states to decide the fate of the inhabitants of their state. Whereas Canada is more like the government says something and the provinces are like, okay.
In the United States, when it comes to environmental regulations, you are allowed to have your state become what's called an authorized state. And in order to be an authorized state, you have to come up with regulations that are at least as stringent as the EPA regulations, but potentially more stringent. And EPA reviews them and they either, you know, say, yep, that works and you can have this be your regulations, or EPA says, go back to the drawing board. They need to be a little more stringent. And so in the area that I live in, up here in New England, a lot of the states are authorized states and they do have more stringent state regulations than the EPA federal regulations.
What's the consequence if you're not an authorized state? You're just...
So if you're not
an people authorized... Just people trash talk you behind your back?
Well, if you're not an authorized state, then you follow the federal regulations from EPA. And again, I think there's sort of this risk reward argument where some states that follow the EPA regulations, they say they're more business friendly and it's better for their economy and whatnot. And then some of the states that are authorized states, you know, they feel like, well, we need to protect things like drinking water and air quality and whatnot a little bit more. And, you know, so it's kind of the risk reward, trying to find the sweet spot where you're not regulating people too heavily, where you still have an economy and you still have businesses that can manufacture things that people need, but you don't want it to be too lax where you have significant issues with environmental health and public health.
Oof, that's why I am a teacher and not a politician. That is a tightrope I would not be good at.
It's very interesting how often politics can play into environmental regulations.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I'm sure that was a whole podcast right there.
It probably is, yes.
My other question I have for you, and I know you had mentioned it was only a short blip kind of in your career, but you worked at a lead lab. What is that? It sounds cool. It sounds like amazing, but I'm thinking it's have to do something with like testing for lead. But could you talk about it for a little bit?
Sure. So as I mentioned, the first company I worked for in my career, they were very heavily focused on lead and asbestos. And so in addition to the bridge work that I mentioned, we also did work for public housing and any place that was constructed before 1978, there is the potential for lead-based paint if it's located in the United States. And up here in New England, we have some pretty old houses. You know, for example, I live in a house that was built in 1774. And okay. we're not even the oldest house in town.
Wow. Okay.
So you have a lot of older houses and, you know, and there is the potential for lead-based paint. And so we would go in and take samples to verify if there was lead-based paint or not. And if there was, then a company would come in and remediate it or remove that lead-based paint. And then we would have to do clearance samples afterwards to make sure that subsequent to the removal, that everything was cleaned up properly and there was not any residue left behind. And so typically to do that whole sequence of events, you would have lead-based paint chips that would come in that would need to be analyzed. And then at the end, you would do wipe samples that would pick up any dust that was left behind after the abatement. And we would analyze those to make sure that they were clean and they didn't have any lead content in it. And so it was my job in the lead lab to take those samples in, digest the samples, run them through an AA spectrometer and, you know, and come up with the result and tell people, yes, you can move back in. Your place is clean, or we would have to go back to the abatement company and tell them to try again and clean up a little bit better.
Yeah, I was gonna ask if you had to use a spectrometer, and I don't know how else you would do it to find the exact element of lead in the sample.
Yep, we did. We used a spectrometer, and the interesting thing was I kind of got thrown into running the lead lab. The person who had ran it left, just kind of got up and quit one day, and I went to a college that had a lot of hands-on experience, even for undergrads. And so I was one of the only few people in the company at the time that had ever ran an AA before.
That's cool. So, there you go.
Yeah. And that's how I got pulled in to run the lead lab for a little bit. And I sort of, you know, held the fort down and kept things going for a while until a new person got hired and I trained that person and they took over. But, you know, again, you're talking about people's, you know, being able to return to their home, you know, so you don't want to put things on hold. So I was more than happy to jump in and analyze those samples while we were kind of getting ducks in a row on our side of things. And I remember one night, like I stayed really, really late to, you know, finish up digesting and analyzing some samples because it made the difference between people being able to return home and celebrate Thanksgiving in their house versus, you know, celebrating it in a hotel room.
What a gong show job to like get the lead paint out of a house though. Hey,
yes. Oh,
that you need a team of people to scrape and vacuum and wow. And they'd have to wear like crazy protective equipment too.
Right.
Really, really strong respirators even. Huh?
Yes. They usually use PAPRs, which are you know, the powered sources. Yeah.
Wow. Man, what are the issues going to be in like 60, 70, 100 years? People are going to be like, wow, those people used whatever in their houses. We got to go fix those houses. So I'm always worried about that.
Yeah. And that's the interesting thing with environmental, you know, regulations and whatnot. I know for a while, you know, they were saying MBTE, which is an additive in gasoline that got used, you know, that was going to be great for air pollution control. But, you know, if you have a tank that's leaking gasoline and it's leaking MBTE, the additive, that likes to break down into some pretty nasty things like xylene.
No way. And so, that's not good. It's a super carcinogen.
Right. Exactly. You know, and so it's sort of that, again, that risk reward, that finding that sweet spot where, you know, you're sort of got things under control, but it's not too restrictive. And it's an interesting spot to try to find.
Hmm. Well, thanks for talking about the lead lab. That's fascinating.
Of course.
So we're at the section of the podcast where we kind of shift things into more stuff about your life that isn't around science. And one of them is the questions we always ask our guests about a pet story from their life. Do you have a pet story you could share with us?
I have several pet stories I could probably share with you, but I'll pick only one. But just to kind of give you an idea of my repertoire I have to pull from, I grew up with a black lab named Luke that was about 110 pounds.
Oh, he's a big boy.
Then, yeah, he was a big boy. He was a definite big boy. And then when I was on my own, you know, and living in an apartment and whatnot, I really wanted a dog, but I just wasn't in a position where it would be a good idea to have a dog. Mm-hmm. And so I adopted an adult cat from a rescue, and her name was Nittany. And I still, despite having Nittany, I still really needed a dog fix. And so I started volunteering for a canine search and rescue team as a live find subject.
Oh, that's cool. You're like the distressed dead person.
Yeah, well, not dead, but
well, yes. No, I'm sorry. You were the person in distress. You were the still alive trapped person or whatever.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry. I didn't mean to be grisly. In Canada, we have those for avalanches. Like they got to go bury somebody with a breathing tube.
Yeah, so it's a similar thing, except, you know, I still do it occasionally now. I go hide in the woods or I hide in a rubble pile and, you know, and the dogs that are trying to get certified, they go and try to find me. And so that, I still do that, even though I do have a dog now. My husband and I, about 7.5 years ago, we adopted a rescue. She's about 60 pounds and she, I think, is probably a lab hound mix. And her name is Maggie.
Aw.
And we also acquired 6 chickens this spring as well.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Does your area of Rhode Island allow you to have like chickens, or may, are you in the country?
We're pretty rural where
okay,
we're
gotcha,
located.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So we're actually, there's a bunch of sod farms that surround us. So we're pretty rural, but we have 4 Rhode Island Reds and 2 Easter Eggers.
Oh, they have like special names. Hey,
we have
chickens and they're just chickens. So I'm not sure what they are.
Oh no, those are the breeds. Those are the breeds.
Yeah. Yeah. I have no idea what breeds of chickens we have. They're just chickens.
Yeah. So I think the story I want to tell, though, is about my childhood dog, Luke.
Okay.
So in the house I grew up in, my parents' bedroom was a loft that looked out into the living room. And we had forced hot air that came out of vents in the floor. And so for my parents, their heat source was the vent that was located in the living room, and the heat would rise and they would be toasty warm in their bedroom. And I had a separate bedroom on the first floor, and I had my own dedicated heat vent. And so one winter, my parents kept on complaining about how they were so cold at night, and they thought something was wrong with the heating system. And I was toasty warm in my room. And I said, well, it's not the boiler, because I'm very, very warm in my room. So maybe it's something wrong with the heating duct. And so my dad took a look, and he couldn't figure out anything that was wrong with the heating system. And then he called in a professional, and the professional came and looked and said, I can't find anything wrong. And so my parents, you know, chalked it up to an anomaly. And then, you know, a week later, they were very cold at night again, and the heating guy came back out again. And I think this happened probably 4 times where the heating person came out and could not find anything wrong with the heating system. And so one night, my mom didn't feel well, and she got up in the middle of the night and went downstairs to use the bathroom. And she noticed that our black lab, who was 110 pounds, had moved his dog bed on top of the heating vent. And so he basically was creating a heated dog bed for himself.
That was so smart.
And he was so warm, you know, he was so large that he was blocking any other heat from getting out from that vent. And that was why my parents were cold, but I was still toasty warm. And it turns out that he was moving the bed over the vent after they went to bed. And then he would hear their alarm go off in the morning, and he would move his bed off of the heating vent. So he
I was going to ask, like, how was he being sneaky like that? And obviously, yes,
he was. He was being very sneaky like that.
Oh man, we don't deserve dogs. They're just so good.
he was interesting. He was probably like the smartest dopey dog ever that I've met.
Yeah. Sometimes those derpy dogs surprise you with their, you know, their sneaky intelligence.
Exactly.
Well, that is a hilarious story. Thanks for sharing it.
Of course.
the other question that we is kind of standard that we ask our guests is for the super fact. And the super fact is something that you know that when you tell people, it kind of like blows their mind a bit. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
I do. So have you ever heard of the term slow as molasses?
I have. Yes.
Okay. So keep that in mind while I'm telling you about the super fact. So in January of 1919, there was a storage tank that was over 2 million gallons that was located in the north end of Boston, Massachusetts.
Two million gallons.
It was over 2 million. I think it was 2.3 million gallons.
Oh, wait a second. I got to convert that to liters. I have no concept of what that is.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm better with kilometers than liters to gallons.
Holy heck. That's like almost 4 million liters.
Yes, it's big.
Okay, sorry.
So there was the 2.3 million gallon tank in Boston that was constructed to store molasses. And so there was some poor engineering involved, and it was constructed in a hurry. And the tank leaked from day one. And one January day in 1919, the tank burst. And it resulted in a 35 mile an hour tidal wave of molasses.
What?
Yes. 35 mile an hour tidal wave of molasses. And unfortunately, 21 people were killed and 150 people were injured by the tidal wave of molasses.
Was it just so hot or they drowned in it?
So they couldn't escape it because it was 35 miles an hour and they ended up getting stuck in it and drowning in it.
Oh my God.
And so there was a big lawsuit and the company that owned the tank, it was probably, I think, one of the first class action lawsuits that occurred in the United States. And the company was found liable. And the city of Boston decided after this incident that anytime a storage tank was to be constructed, that you had to have design plans that were stamped by a professional engineer, and it had to go to the city for review. And this was the start of the first storage tank regulations in the United States.
Wow. So molasses doesn't necessarily have to be slow.
It does not. And apparently, because it's a non-Newtonian fluid, if you have enough of it, it can go pretty quickly.
Crazy. Well, it's pretty cold when we use molasses when we make gingerbread at Christmas time. So I think that's the only time we ever use molasses.
Yeah, so, we use it for ginger snaps at our house.
There you go. So maybe that, I don't know. I think we make gingerbread men out of it. So yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to respect molasses a little bit differently now, and I know it can be used for destruction if it's stored incorrectly.
I'll send you a photo. It's pretty interesting to see just the quantity of destruction that happened.
Oh my goodness.
From 2 million gallons of molasses.
Okay. We'll see if we can put that in the ad for the podcast too. I think people would find that, you know, interesting, but also morbidly curious. That is a super fact. My mind is blown. I'm a little terrified right now, but anyways, that's okay. It's a super terrifying fact.
Hopefully you don't have a 2 million gallon tank nearby.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure there's 2 million gallon tanks of maple syrup around here, and that could take out a bunch of people too. So the last section of the podcast is a really fun one. It's where we get to learn a little bit more about our science guests personally, and it's what they're passionate about. It could be a cause, it could be a hobby. Now, you have a really interesting take on this. You said your hobbies have also become your cause of volunteerism. You're going to have to explain that one.
So this question was probably the toughest one of the interview. I feel because there's so many things that I really enjoy doing outside of work. And, you know, I mentioned I like to, you know, sail. I mentioned I hide for the dogs and whatnot. And I'm really fortunate in that some of the things that I'm really passionate about doing and I enjoy doing, I can do and it benefits others. So, for example, you know, I love sailing, I love kayaking, I love hiking, and I volunteered for Big Sisters for a number of years, and I gave a child an opportunity to experience those things that she might not have gotten otherwise, you know, where okay. She got to go out sailing, she got to go kayaking, she got to go hiking, and so that was great.
What a great experience for a kid, though.
Right. And then I like hiking and camping, and that ties in with hiding for the search dogs, you know, where I get to go hike out and sort of set up a little camp and wait for the dogs to find me. I enjoy photography, and I've done some photography of events for the ALS Association.
Okay.
I enjoy knitting. I'm an avid knitter, and I've knitted things for the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, and a local warming center ran by the American Legion Post that's in our town. And, you know, I've got many other examples like this, but to me, it's just really fulfilling to do those things that I enjoy doing and knowing at the end that somebody else is going to benefit from it as well.
That's really altruistic. Very cool.
Thank you.
It, a couple times pre-COVID, I got to do events for charity with my costumes, my cosplay stuff. And that was super rewarding.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the same sort of thing, you know, and I've done some volunteering too, involving, you know, my technical skills and science as well. I know with Big Sisters, I've done, you know, STEM outreach at elementary schools, and I've helped our local emergency management agency with some, you know, chemical details when it came to emergency response and whatnot. And that's fun too, you know, when you get to use those professional skills as well.
Yeah. Well, what a positive way to end our interview together. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
I mean, it was definitely a good 90-degree turn from the molasses death wave. So I'm glad we were able to go down this route. So that's great.
I'm glad I could help recover that.
No, it's good. I'm going to be thinking about that for days. Beth, this has been such a pleasure to talk to you today. I'm sure there's more conversation to be had, but our time is over. Do you have anything on social media people could follow, like an account or a website or anything like that?
So I do have a Twitter account. I don't have a ton of original information about science. I do retweet a lot of articles that I think are important. I do tweet some information about regulations that are open for public comments, which I would encourage people to take that opportunity to make public comment on any environmental regulations, either at the federal level or at the state level. And then there's sort of a mishmash of, you know, pictures of my dog and, you know, pictures from sailing and that kind of thing. If you look up knowledge equals power, I'll pop up.
Yeah, it's at experiment with X, experiment. We'll make sure there's a link in the show notes. Again, thank you for chatting with us today on the Science Podcast. Have yourself a pleasant evening, and thank you again for chatting with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast, and I have patron Melinda Campbell with me today. How are you doing today, Melinda?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. Where are you calling into the podcast from?
I'm calling in from Denver, Colorado.
Oh, Colorado. Colorado's a beautiful state. I've been there a couple times in my life.
It is. And we're in the same time zone, so that makes it easy.
Yeah. Couple of our Australian guests, they always have to call in from the future, and that's like a planning thing. So, yeah. Well, you know, Colorado's mountain time is very apropos for both you and where you live and where I live. So
yeah, we're lucky.
And you're a patron of Bunsen and Beaker content. How did you find Bunsen and or Beaker?
I first found Bunsen before you had Beaker, and I found you through Thoughts of Dog and Dog Rates. Matt is incredible.
Yeah, we love Matt. He's such a great, he's so young too.
I know.
He's only 24. That guy is he's a genius.
He is, and a kind genius at
he
that.
He is exactly. Very kind person. Yeah. And well, just before we get going, from my family to yours, thanks for being a patron of our account and our content. Thank you.
I am so happy to support you guys. You make a big difference in my world.
Oh, thanks. And you're retired. What did you do for a career before you took time off for yourself and retired?
40-some years ago, I started in broadcast journalism and moved to freelancing when I had kids. And then when I needed money to raise those kids, I moved into screenwriting. Oh. And when I finished that, I somehow ended up working for a church as a children's minister and Christian ed person.
Oh, cool.
Which led me to a PhD in theology, philosophy, and cultural theory, and working as a professor for a couple of years. But you know what? I kind of hated that.
Oh.
I loved the teaching. I loved the kids. I hated the grading.
The marking? Yeah, it's definitely a drag, isn't it?
It's horrible, horrible. And so I actually took a retirement job at IKEA and loved that until the pandemic. And then when the pandemic came on, I've got a couple of health factors that I went ahead and retired.
Well, you know what? You got to protect yourself. Yes.
Yeah, you do.
You made a good point about grading. Any aspiring teachers that are listening to this or people thinking about going into education or teaching, I'll tell you right now, rubrics are your key. Like that. Let's get on with Woo or Wow. Okay. Woo or Wow is, if you're just listening to this for the first time, it's a bit of a trivia. I challenge my contestant which is you, Melinda. I will read you three statements. Two of them are fake. They're woo. One of them is true. It's a wow. And you have to try and find the true statement. So remember, only one of these statements is true. And the theme this week is stars.
Okay.
All right. Now, I think in Colorado, depending on where you go, you have less light pollution than some of the other more populous states.
My favorite place is the Sand Dunes National Monument.
Right. I've read about that. Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah. Wonderful stargazing there. We have to go a little bit west of where we live. And yeah, even out in the country, we have a little bit of light pollution from the city we live close to. But once you go a little bit of ways, yeah, the night sky just pops out. All right, stars. You ready for this?
Yes, 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 yes.
Okay. Statement one, the hottest stars are red in color.
False.
You think so? Okay. Don't guess till the end, remember?
Okay.
It's all good. Statement two, the largest stars have the shortest lives. And statement three, the stars in the night sky twinkle because the stars cycle through high and low levels of solar intensity.
Okay. Well, I'm pretty sure the first one is false because if I recall, blue flames are hotter than red flames.
Okay.
The second one, I don't know anything about, but the third one, I know stars do cycle in intensity to a certain amount, but I always thought they twinkled because of the atmosphere around the Earth. What was the second one again?
Yeah, I'll do a quick recap just for everybody and you yourself too. Number one was the hottest stars are red. Number two is the most massive stars have the shortest lives. And statement three, stars twinkle in the night sky as they cycle through levels of high and low solar intensity.
Well, on number two, I always think before a star goes supernova, it gets really big, right? Am I right?
Oh, I can't tell you that.
I watched a lot of Star Trek and Star Wars and all those kind of things. I'm going to say number two is the woo.
Number two is the wow.
And the other two are woos.
Okay, all right. Final answer, Melinda.
I'm just guessing. I think number two is wow.
Okay, all right. We'll lock you in. Now, you were pretty sure about that first one right off the start. The hottest stars are red. That is a untrue statement. You are correct.
Cool.
Yeah, you're right. Blue is the hottest color. And our sun is a yellow-white star, which is kind of in the middle, where red is actually the coolest of colors.
Okay.
All right. Now we're down to the last two, the size of the star versus their life and twinkle, twinkle, little star. Which statement do you want to hear first, being true or false?
Tell me about twinkle, twinkle.
Okay. So you said the second one was true, right?
Yes.
Okay. So we'll know if you win with my answer to this, right? Okay. Stars twinkle in the night skies. They cycle through levels of high and low solar intensity is false. That's the woo. So you win. Good job. You nailed it. Stars twinkle because of our atmosphere. The higher you go, like up on a mountain, the less they twinkle. And then when you're in outer space, depending on where you are, they usually don't twinkle much at all.
Well, I seem to recall that from the early, was it the Apollo or the Gemini, where they got out and went around the Earth a few times. And I seem to remember the astronaut saying something about that. So.
Yeah, it's... Cool. Yeah, well done. Good memory. I guess there's something to be said for watching Star Trek and Star Wars then.
I think so. But do the ones with the shortest life, is that because they've already had a long life or?
No, it has to do with the amount of fuel and really complex gravity. Okay. I'd have to do a little bit more research to give you the main reason, but the big, 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 big stars, mm-hmm. they burn hot and they die young. Wow. The little stars, like our stars, medium size, but there's little teeny stars comparatively called red dwarfs. And yes, they have the longest lives. They just last and last and last.
Well, cool. Oh, I'm so glad. I love trivia. So thank you, Jason. Thank you.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. It was great to chat with you for the first time. Thanks for being brave and coming to the call for Woo or Wow from the patron page.
Well, thanks for playing trivia, and please give Bunsen and Beaker big pats from me.
I will. They're both sleeping right now. It's their giant morning nap. So
yes. Well, thank you, Jason.
Okay, it's time for story time with me, Adam. If you don't know what story time is, story time is when we talk about stories that have happened within the past 1 or 2 weeks. Incidentally, again, our stories are about the island and being on the island. I will go first. My story is about the Beaker. So I was, yes, the Beaker. I was on the stand-up paddleboard and we were going out to the ocean. And the ocean, if you don't know, is a pretty wavy place. And on a paddleboard, you got to accommodate for those waves. So you got to shift your balance. Now, with a paddleboard as well, you have to be pretty good balance in the first place. So you got to keep your center of balance above where the paddleboard is, and if it tips over, you fall off. Kind of like a skateboard. But on the ocean, and the ocean is freezing. So once you put in a dog that's moving around when you don't want them to move around, it becomes very difficult for you to balance. So I get pretty far out there, about up to like my shoulders, which is, I don't know how tall that is, it doesn't really matter, but I'm out there, and now Beaker is deciding to jump around from the front to the back of the paddleboard and move around a lot, and a wave came, knocked my balance off, and then Beaker started moving around, and then we both fell into the ocean. And then when Beaker fell into the ocean, she was like, oh no. And then she started paddling to Dad, and Dad took her, and then she was soaking wet in Dad's kayak. So yeah, that's the dangers of taking the Beaker on a paddleboard. And now we know. That's my story. Mom, do you have a story?
I sure do. My story is subsequent to Beaker landing in the ocean. I was able to get that on. I was going to say on tape, but then I'm kind of dating myself by saying I got that on tape. Regardless, what I did miss was Bunsen jumping off into the ocean. He was in the kayak, and if you watch the little video clip, he's looking over at me going, why am I here? Why am I here? And I was walking up and down, pacing the ocean on the shore just to, you know, see how everything was going. And I missed Bunsen jumping out of the kayak and feeling all dejected. But when he came into shore, he was not looking at Jason, had no interest in looking at Jason, in communicating with Jason, in basically it was, you're dead to me.
He was shunning, shun on, re-shun.
Yes. And that's my story. Just Bunsen just sitting by me looking like the Sphinx and just turning his head ever so slightly away from Jason because he was on ignore. Thanks for letting me fall into the ocean. And that's my story.
And Dad, do you have a story?
We had a great time on the island. My story is about our drive through the forest fire. A lot of people were asking, did the dogs know we were driving through that massive forest fire on the Coquihalla? And the answer is, I don't think they did. I don't think they were even, I think Beaker was sleeping. And Bunsen was maybe feeding off of Chris's stress. Our van was actually having a little bit of trouble accelerating up hills in the highest parts of the Coquihalla. We think it has something to do with the catalytic converter not getting enough oxygen. So that was a sketchy if you're driving through a forest fire and you're, you know, up a giant hill, you having trouble accelerating. Luckily, by that time, the situation had stopped happening in the van. But it was still kind of terrifying. Driving through the forest fire because you could feel the heat and our van, smelled like smoke. I think it probably still smells like smoke. I don't know. I haven't been driving it, but, the van was covered in ash in the morning and, I feel really bad for the people that live around there. It's been a while. I don't know if the Cocoa Hall is open, but that forest, that fire was insane. It was crazy. So hopefully the people in BC, the forest fire crews have got it under control. That's my story.
Yeah, I don't know if Dad mentioned this, but the smoke was coming down like fallout. You could see it just raining down like snow.
It was crazy.
Yeah, it wasn't very great. It wasn't good to breathe in because it's not good for the lungs.
It burned my throat.
Yes, it burns your throat. Anyway, that is story time. I hope to see you guys next time on the podcast. And yeah, bye-bye.
That's the end of our podcast episode for this week. Thanks for coming back week after week to listen. Special thanks to our guest, Beth Fitzpatrick, who talked to us about environmental consulting. We'd also like to give a special shout out to our top tier patrons on Patreon. If you'd like to hear your name in the podcast, head over and sign up. Take it away, Chris.
Samantha Dodd, Kimberly Bond, Nate Stevenson, Debbie Anderson, Courtney Proven, Renee Hardy, Mary Rader, Shelby Leggett, Dan Bry, Mary Coos, Katla Lynch, Marianne McNally, Andrea Persons, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Karen Beth St. George, Bianca Hyde, Lynn Armstrong, Lisa Swartz, Catherine Jordan, Donna Craig, Lila Ashier, Jody Ogren, Liz Button, Kathy Zerker, and Ben Rathert.
Let's close with the dog's motto: for science, empathy, and cuteness.